Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Ladies and gentlemen, the captain has turned on the fasten seatbelt sign. If you haven't already done so, please make sure the volume of this podcast is set perfectly to your listening enjoyment. Please take your seat, whether that's on the treadmill, car, sofa, or bed, and buckle in for the last trip. My name is Jamie Beebe, and I'll be your tour guide, recreating someone's last days in paradise. On behalf of myself and everyone behind the scenes, please enjoy the Last Trip podcast. And because nobody likes a long flight to get to where they want to be, let's prepare for takeoff. On March 31st, 2007, 32-year-old Nicole Viennu left her hotel in Hama, Syria for a day of sightseeing. She was nearing the end of a six-month solo backpacking trip through West Africa and the Middle East, and nothing about that morning suggested it would be any different from the countless others she had spent exploring on her own. Nicole left her belongings behind and walked out of the hotel. She was never seen again. No confirmed sightings, no clear trail, and no explanation. Somewhere in Hama, Nicole Viennu seemingly vanished into thin air. When we talk about Nicole traveling alone through Syria in 2007, I think we have to be really careful not to look at that decision through the lens of the Syria we know today, because they are almost two different worlds. If you hear solo female backpacker in Syria now, your immediate reaction is probably, why would anyone do that? And today, I would agree with you. As of July 2026, the Canadian government advises its citizens to avoid all travel to Syria. And the U.S. State Department is even more direct with a level 4, do not travel. There are warnings of terrorism, kidnapping, hostage taking, unexploded ordnance, and armed conflict. The United States still does not operate an embassy there, meaning its ability to help Americans inside the country is extremely limited. I would not go to Syria right now. And I definitely wouldn't recommend that one of our listeners plan a solo backpacking trip there. But that doesn't mean Nicole made some insane or reckless decision in 2007. Syria, before the war, was actually an established destination for adventurous, independent travelers. And reading old travel writing about Syria is heartbreaking, because people absolutely loved traveling there. They talked about the history, the food, wandering through markets. But over and over again, they talked about the people. Syrian hospitality had an incredible reputation among travelers. People would tell stories about asking someone for directions and somehow ending up drinking tea with their entire family. You might get invited to dinner. Someone might insist on helping you find the correct bus. People wanted to know where you were from, where you had traveled, and what you thought of Syria. There was a ridiculous amount of history packed into one relatively small country. You could start in Damascus, one of the world's oldest continuously inhabited cities, and walk through the old city surrounded by layers of Roman, Christian, Islamic, and Ottoman history. You could spend hours wandering through Souk al-Hamidiya, the enormous covered market where shops sold everything from spices and sweets to clothing, jewelry, and handicrafts. Then, suddenly you would emerge from this crowded marketplace and find yourself standing in front of the Umayyad Mosque, one of the most important and beautiful religious buildings in the Islamic world. And the fascinating thing about Damascus was that all of these different periods of history were literally stacked on top of each other. Roman columns were just there. Ancient walls were part of everyday neighborhoods. A doorway might lead into a courtyard house that had been occupied in one form or another for hundreds of years. The Lonely Planet Guide from 2009 describes Damascus as a place of crumbling palaces, mysterious souks, antique shops, and stories seemingly hidden everywhere you looked. And then you had Aleppo. Before the war, Aleppo's old city was one of the great historic urban centers of the Middle East. There was the massive citadel sitting above the city. If you love archaeology, Syria was unbelievable. You had Palmyra, this enormous ancient city sitting in the desert. Imagine coming across Roman columns stretching toward the horizon with basically nothing around them except sand and mountains. You had Basra with its extraordinary Roman theater. You had Apamea, where Nicole spent the day before she disappeared walking along ancient colonnaded streets. You had Crusader castles, Byzantine monasteries, Roman ruins, early Christian settlements, the so-called dead cities, hundreds of abandoned ancient settlements scattered across northwestern Syria. And you had places like the beehive houses, the places Nicole apparently hoped to see on the morning she disappeared. For someone who loved history and architecture, Syria wasn't just another country. It was basically an open-air museum. And you didn't necessarily have to experience these places as part of some giant organized tour. That's another thing that was very different. Independent travel was absolutely possible. You could stay in inexpensive hotels. You could take buses and minibuses between towns. You could negotiate with a taxi driver to take you somewhere remote. You could sit in a cafe, ask another backpacker where they'd been the day before, and decide, "That sounds amazing. I'll go there tomorrow." Which is basically what Nicole did. She heard other travelers talking about the beehive houses. She became interested. The next morning, she asked how to get there. There wasn't anything inherently strange about that. That was backpacking. And Syria's tourism industry was actually growing dramatically around this period. By 2008, Syria was receiving around 6 million visitors. And by 2010, that number had climbed to approximately 8.5 million, according to Syrian tourism officials. Tourism was bringing billions of dollars into the economy, and the government was actively investing in expanding the industry. So Nicole wasn't wandering through a country where foreigners simply don't go. She was part of a growing tourism scene. Now, that doesn't mean Syria in 2007 was some perfectly safe utopia. It wasn't, and I don't want to romanticize it. Syria was an authoritarian state under Bashar al-Assad. There were extensive security services. Political dissent could have very serious consequences. Internet access was restricted. Foreign travelers had to be careful around government buildings, military installations, and politically sensitive areas. And there were regional tensions and occasional terrorist attacks. So, safe for tourists and free society are two very different things. A visitor could have a wonderful vacation, while a Syrian citizen criticizing the government faced a completely different reality. But for an ordinary foreign traveler who wasn't there to engage in politics, Syria generally had a reputation as a relatively safe place to travel. There's actually a comment from a traveler who visited Syria in 2008 that really captures what you see repeatedly in recollections from that period. They said they spent 4 weeks traveling around the country by bus and minibus, never felt unsafe, and remembered local people as extraordinarily friendly and helpful. That's anecdotal, obviously, but it matches the broader reputation Syria had among independent travelers before the war. And then everything changed. In 2011, demonstrations against Bashar al-Assad's government began as part of the wider Arab Spring. The government's crackdown escalated. The uprising became an armed conflict. And eventually Syria descended into one of the most devastating wars of the modern era. Tourism collapsed almost overnight. Hotels that had once housed backpackers were suddenly empty or housing displaced people. Tour operators stopped running trips. Airlines suspended routes. Foreign governments told their citizens to leave. And then the physical places tourists had traveled to see began disappearing too. Aleppo was devastated by years of fighting. Historic neighborhoods were destroyed. Parts of its famous souk burned. Archaeological sites were damaged and looted. and Palmyra became internationally infamous after ISIS seized the ancient city and deliberately destroyed major monuments. So when you look at photographs of Syria from Nicole's trip, you're not just looking at Nicole's past. In some cases, you're looking at a world that no longer exists in the same form. And that's what I find so haunting about it. Because Nicole disappeared only 4 years before the war began. She traveled through Syria during this little window of time where independent travelers could still move around the country fairly easily. She could walk into a hotel in Hama, take a minibus to Apamea, sit among Roman ruins reading a book, come back around sunset, ask other backpackers what she should see tomorrow, and then just go. But by 2012, her family couldn't even realistically search for her anymore. The country containing the answer to Nicole's disappearance was inaccessible. And today, despite major political changes since the fall of Assad in December 2024 and efforts to eventually revive tourism, Syria is still not somewhere I would recommend visiting. The current U.S. advisory says no part of the country can be considered safe from violence and to avoid all travel. Now that's important because you may occasionally see travel influencers visiting Syria now. That does not mean the official risk has disappeared. Maybe someday it will, and I genuinely hope it does, because Syria should be known for more than war. Especially for the Syrian people, who travelers describe again and again as generous, curious, and extraordinarily hospitable. That is the Syria Nicole experienced. And I think understanding that changes the way we look at her disappearance. Because Nicole didn't knowingly walk into a war zone. She wasn't chasing danger. She was visiting a country with a growing tourism industry, traveling along established backpacker routes, staying in a hotel used by foreign travelers and taking ordinary sightseeing trips to some of the country's most famous historical sites. The tragedy is that something happened to her there. But Nicole's disappearance shouldn't rewrite the entire country she visited as inherently sinister or dangerous. Because sometimes people disappear in places where everyone tells you not to go. And sometimes they disappear somewhere you felt perfectly comfortable. For Nicole, Syria wasn't supposed to be the dangerous part of her trip. It was supposed to be one of the beautiful parts.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
Before we get into Nicole's disappearance, I want to spend some time talking about who she actually was. Because it's easy to make assumptions when you hear about a woman traveling through Syria solo. That maybe she was inexperienced. Maybe she was reckless. Maybe she wandered into a situation she wasn't prepared for. But that doesn't really describe Nicole at all. Her full name was Jacqueline Nicole Viano, although she went by Nicole. And by the time she disappeared, she had been traveling independently through remote parts of the world for somewhere around 15 years. She was an experienced adventure traveler, and her family clearly saw her that way too. When she left on the trip that would eventually take her to Syria, they weren't particularly worried about her ability to navigate unfamiliar places. She'd been doing it for years. Nicole grew up in Toronto, but after graduating from high school, she moved across the country to Vancouver. And she was an artist. She studied at Emily Carr University in Vancouver and earned a degree in fine arts. She painted and had a real interest in history and architecture, which makes the kind of travel she gravitated toward make a lot more sense. She wasn't necessarily traveling to lie on a beach or check famous landmarks off a list. She wanted to see places that felt different, places with history, places that most tourists weren't going. One account from someone who knew and traveled with Nicole remembered her as someone who loved the outdoors and adventure and had an unusual ability to feel comfortable across cultures and make other people feel comfortable around her. And I think that distinction is really important because Nicole didn't just like vacations. She liked traveling. There's a difference. These were not two-week trips where you stay at a resort and come home. Nicole would disappear into the world for 6, 7, 8, sometimes 9 months at a time. In fact, a 6-month trip was practically short by Nicole's standards. Over the decade or more before she disappeared, she had spent months traveling through Asia, through Latin America, through Southern and Eastern Africa, and she often did it alone. And that tells you something about her personality. You have to be incredibly independent to travel that way, especially during the 1990s and early 2000s. There was no iPhone in your pocket, no Google Maps telling you exactly where you were, no Uber, no instant translation app. You couldn't necessarily book every hotel online before arriving. Travel like that required you to talk to people. You had to ask directions, figure out buses, trust your instincts, navigate cultural differences, change plans when something went wrong. And Nicole apparently thrived on that. Someone who knew her described her as having multicultural dexterity, basically an ability to move between very different cultures and connect with people without making them feel uncomfortable. And she wasn't particularly political, and she wasn't religious. Her interests seemed to be much more about people, places, art, history, architecture, and the experience of seeing the world for herself. Her father, David Vianney, actually came from a very political world. He was a respected Canadian journalist who covered Ottawa politics for the Toronto Star and later Global Television. He had joined the Star in 1975 and eventually became its Ottawa bureau chief before moving to television. And David died of cancer several years before Nicole disappeared at only 53 years old. But despite growing up with a father immersed in politics, Nicole apparently had very little interest in politics herself. She wanted to see the world. And travel also became something that connected Nicole with her older brother, Matthew. Matthew has been very open about the fact that the two of them didn't always get along growing up, which honestly makes their relationship pretty relatable. I mean, they were siblings, they fought, they had different personalities and different lives. But as they got older, that changed. They reconnected, and eventually travel became part of that relationship. During one of Nicole's trips through Africa, Matthew happened to be traveling to Cape Town for work. Afterward, he met up with Nicole at Victoria Falls, and the two spent roughly 3 weeks traveling together through Botswana, Namibia, and South Africa. Matthew would later describe it as the best trip of his life. And knowing what happened later makes that incredibly bittersweet, because those weeks gave Matthew a chance to experience the version of Nicole that people she met around the world already knew. The capable traveler who could land somewhere unfamiliar and somehow figure it out. By 2006, Nicole was ready to leave again. This time, she planned an enormous journey beginning in West Africa and eventually ending in Turkey. She started in Morocco and intended to travel through countries that received far fewer tourists, including Mali and Ghana, before flying north to Egypt and continuing through the Middle East. This wasn't a spontaneous backpacking trip. It was another chapter in a life Nicole had deliberately built around seeing parts of the world most people only read about. And her family actually joined her for portions of it. Matthew and his partner traveled with Nicole for about a month during this final trip before eventually saying goodbye to her in Jordan in mid-March of 2007. And Nicole continued on alone. But traveling alone didn't mean disappearing from everyone at home. She had a rule with her family. Every 14 days, she had to check in. Her mother, Catherine Murray, had apparently learned years earlier that her daughter's definition of everything is fine could involve being somewhere extremely remote without calling home for a very long time. After one scare in the 1990s, Catherine made it very clear. Nicole had 2 weeks. If 14 days passed without an email or phone call, her mother was going to contact Canadian Foreign Affairs and have somebody start looking for her. And Nicole took that rule seriously. Her mother later recalled that Nicole never missed that deadline afterward. Even if all she had time to communicate was essentially, "I'm alive, I have to go." I actually love that detail because it tells you so much about both of them. Nicole was fiercely independent. Her mom knew she wasn't going to stop her daughter from traveling through Africa or the Middle East alone. So they found a compromise. Go wherever you want, just tell me you're alive every 2 weeks. And Nicole did. She was also regularly communicating with her longtime partner and fiancé, Gary Schweitzer, back in Vancouver. Nicole also had a large blended family. Her mother, Catherine, and stepfather, Bruce, were part of her life, along with Matthew and her younger step and half-siblings. And I think all this matters, because Nicole's disappearance would eventually be reduced to a very simple headline, Canadian backpacker missing in Syria. But there was an entire person behind that headline. A woman who loved history and architecture and the outdoors, and who apparently felt more comfortable wandering through unfamiliar places than most of us feel navigating our own cities. And she wasn't new to solo travel. She wasn't somebody who suddenly decided at 32 to throw a backpack over her shoulder and head into the Middle East without understanding what that meant. And that's part of what makes what happened to her so difficult to understand. Because when Nicole stopped communicating in the spring of 2007, her family knew her patterns. They knew she could handle herself. They knew she sometimes went to places where communication wasn't easy. But they also knew one thing with absolute certainty. Nicole always checked in. And this time, she didn't.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
By the time Nicole arrived in Hamas, Syria, she had already been traveling for months. It was Thursday, March 29, 2007, and Nicole checked into the Cairo Hotel sometime that afternoon. Hamas sits north of Damascus, an ancient city built along the Orontes River, famous for its enormous wooden water wheels, or Nuraias. In 2007, it was also a popular stopping point for independent backpackers because it made a convenient base for visiting some of the archaeological sites scattered throughout the surrounding countryside. The following morning, Friday, March 30th, Nicole set out for Apamea, an ancient Greco-Roman city roughly 60 kilometers from Hama. Getting there independently wasn't necessarily simple. Nicole preferred public transportation, so the trip likely involved minibuses, walking, and waiting for connections. But this was exactly the way Nicole liked to travel. She wasn't someone who needed a tour guide waiting in the hotel lobby. She figured things out herself. According to later reconstructions of her movements, Nicole probably spent somewhere around 6 to 8 hours away from Hama that day, including travel time. And unlike what would happen the following morning, we actually have evidence that Nicole made it to Apamea. Witnesses remembered her. She was seen exploring the ruins. But she also did something incredibly Nicole. She found a place to sit down with her book. One later account in her diary describes her writing about the green landscape, wildflowers, birds, butterflies, and the deep blue sky at Apamea. She mentioned treating herself to figs and strawberry ice cream before finally pulling herself away from the ruins. When Nicole returned to Hama around sunset, she sat down to write in her journal. Her final word describing that day was simply content. It's one of those details that becomes devastating only because we know what happens next. There's nothing in Nicole's own writing suggesting she was frightened. Nothing suggesting she thought someone was following her. Nothing suggesting she was planning to disappear. She had spent the afternoon sitting among ancient ruins in the sunshine, reading a book and watching butterflies. She was happy. That evening, Nicole spent time around the hotel. She spoke with other travelers about places she might visit next. The beehive houses came up, traditional mud brick structures found in villages outside Hama. and nearby was another place that would have been especially appealing to someone who loved architecture and history. Nicosia ibn Wardan, and I'm probably saying that wrong, is an isolated 6th century Byzantine complex northeast of Hama. Even today, descriptions of the site emphasize how remote it feels, sitting out in the Syrian landscape away from major tourist centers. For Nicole, it sounded like exactly the kind of place worth making an effort to see. That Friday night, she also attempted to access her Hotmail account. Investigators later obtained information indicating that there were login attempts on March 30th, but the sessions apparently failed or disconnected. And internet access in Syria at the time could be unreliable. Her last successfully completed emails had been sent the previous day. And then came Saturday morning, March 31st, 2007. At approximately 8:30 a.m., according to the hotel desk clerk, Nicole came downstairs and asked how to reach the Beehive Houses and Kassar ibn Wardan. The clerk reportedly explained that Nicole could walk to the area where minibuses left for Al Hamra and continue from there. Nicole apparently declined a private hotel car because it costs more. Again, that fits with what we know about her. She liked local transportation. She wasn't afraid to take buses, and she'd been doing exactly that the day before. According to later accounts, Nicole carefully copied the directions down by hand. And then, supposedly, she left. Except there's a problem. The directions she had spent time copying were later found back in her hotel room. Another set of bus information from the hotel was reportedly left behind as well. And that's always bothered me. Because why painstakingly write down directions to a place you're about to visit and then leave those directions behind? Did Nicole forget them? Did she change her plans? Did someone offer her another way to get there? Or did something happen before she ever needed them? That's something we don't know. And there's another important detail. The desk clerk's account is the only known reported sighting of Nicole that Saturday morning. No second hotel guest independently confirmed seeing her leave. No shopkeeper later came forward and clearly remembered her walking toward the bus stop. No bus driver definitively remembered picking her up. So while the clerk's account became the foundation for the timeline, investigators were left with an uncomfortable question. Did Nicole ever actually reach the bus stop? Her family later emphasized that the streets she should have walked were mainly busy streets, even early in the morning. Yet nobody could place her there. And there's even less evidence that she reached her intended destination. Nicole's journal contained plans to visit the Beehive Houses and Kassar ibn Wardan, supporting the clerk's story that she had been asking about them. She had also written about visiting the Dead Cities, another collection of ancient settlements in northern Syria. But there was no evidence that Nicole made it to any of them. Kassar ibn Wardan maintained a visitor log, and Nicole's name wasn't in it. The family later identified the only known visitor recorded there that day as a man named Amin ben Yahya, and spent years trying to locate him in hopes that he might remember seeing Nicole. And according to later family updates, they did eventually manage to speak with him, but nothing emerged that could explain Nicole's disappearance. People working around the ruins didn't remember seeing Nicole either. And this matters, because Nicole would not necessarily have blended into the crowd. A Western woman traveling alone in that area would have been relatively noticeable. Kassar ibn Wardan itself wasn't seeing enormous numbers of foreign tourists. Years later, another traveler visiting the site remembered how isolated it felt and saw Nicole's missing person poster still sitting beside the guestbook. So the mystery begins to tighten. If Nicole didn't reach the ruins, and no minibus driver remembered seeing her, and no witness could place her along the route, then where exactly did her journey end? Because back at the hotel, almost everything suggested she intended to come back. Her traveling gear, clothing, and journals remained there. And most importantly for someone who loved photography and travel, her camera memory cards were still in the room. Her brother Matthew later specifically pointed to the backpack and memory cards as evidence that Nicole intended to return. There was no obvious preparation for starting a new life. Her bank activity stopped. Her emails stopped. And she never entered Turkey, which had been the next major destination on her itinerary. Canadian officials later confirmed that her passport had not been used to cross into Turkey. Nicole's Syrian visa was also approaching expiration. Everything about her life pointed forward, except Nicole herself was gone. And for a while, nobody even knew exactly where to begin looking. Because when you're a solo traveler, there isn't always someone waiting at the hotel that night who immediately raises an alarm. Nicole had her two-week check-in agreement with her family. So initially, the silence wasn't necessarily terrifying. And then Easter came. Nicole's mother, Catherine, sent her a message. No response. And that bothered her, because Nicole might disappear into remote regions of the world for months at a time, but she'd become extremely disciplined about checking in. And when that two-week deadline passed, Catherine knew something was wrong. On April 19th, the family contacted Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs, and that's when an already frightening situation became even stranger. They knew the broad route she had been taking through the Middle East. They expected her to eventually reach Turkey. But there was no evidence she ever arrived there. The family alerted officials on April 19th, but it wasn't until early May that they finally identified Hama as Nicole's last known location. On April 23rd, Nicole's fiancé Gary made a formal missing person report to the RCMP in Vancouver. On April 29th, the case was submitted through the RCMP to Interpol. But Nicole had already been missing for nearly a month. And this is where her brother Matthew did something that, in 2007, was actually pretty extraordinary. He turned to the internet. Matthew started posting about Nicole online, explaining where she had traveled and asking anyone who might have crossed paths with her to contact him. Now remember, this was before Facebook groups became a routine part of every missing person case. And there wasn't TikTok. There wasn't the kind of instant social media amplification we have today. Matthew essentially built a crowdsourced investigation from scratch. And it worked. Travelers started responding. People who remembered Nicole contacted the family. Others translated information, searched hotel records, contacted people inside Syria, and circulated photographs. Within roughly a day of Matthew's online appeal gaining traction, strangers helped establish that Nicole had been staying at the Cairo Hotel in Hama. Matthew called the hotel, and the response must have been surreal. Yes, Nicole had stayed there, and her things were still there, more than a month after she disappeared. According to later reporting, this internet-based search eventually grew into hundreds of thousands of volunteers around the world. Matthew's blog became the command center for an international investigation, with volunteers interviewing witnesses, translating documents, and chasing down leads that the family felt official channels were moving too slowly to pursue. Suddenly, little fragments of Nicole's trip began coming back to them. Someone remembered seeing her here. Another traveler remembered speaking to her there. Hotel registries were located. Routes were reconstructed. And slowly, the family was able to work backward until they reached March 31st. And then everything stopped. Syrian authorities searched along Nicole's expected route. Bus and minibus drivers were questioned. Her planned sightseeing locations were investigated. Hospitals were checked. The family also investigated whether Nicole could have been injured, detained, or otherwise unable to contact them. But there was no sign of her. No unidentified patient, no confirmed detention, no body, no witness that could say with certainty, "Yes, I saw Nicole after she left the hotel." In May, Matthew and Gary traveled to Syria themselves. Matthew took time away from work, and the two men went to Hama to retrace Nicole's movements and meet with Syrian police and government officials. And Gary took the search even further. He repeatedly traveled the route Nicole was expected to have taken, eventually walking long stretches of the road himself and spending weeks moving across Syria looking for witnesses. Then in July, Catherine and Nicole's stepfather Bruce traveled there as well. Catherine met with senior Syrian officials, including the interior minister, and the family met religious and local leaders. She went on Syrian television and personally appealed for help finding her daughter. Photographs of Nicole appeared in newspapers. Flyers circulated around Hama. The family offered a substantial reward, at one point approximately 1 million Syrian pounds, roughly $20,000 to $25,000, for information that could lead them to Nicole. The case became so well known around Hama that Matthew later described people recognizing family members simply because they knew about the search. And Syrian officials publicly maintained that investigators were continuing to look for Nicole. A Canadian diplomat told AFP that searches were ongoing and that disappearances like Nicole's were unusual in Syria. Still, nothing emerged. No clues at all. And amid all of that uncertainty came one of the cruelest moments in the entire story. The family received communications from men claiming to know where Nicole was and demanding money for her release. For a family desperate to believe Nicole could still be alive, even a ransom demand creates hope. Investigators eventually determined that the men were attempting to exploit the publicity surrounding Nicole's disappearance, and that they did not have Nicole. So the family was thrown right back into the same question they had been asking since April. Where is she? Gary and Catherine continued returning to Syria in the years that followed, meeting with officials and following whatever leads remained. Matthew continued coordinating information online. The reward was later increased, and by 2008, the family's search materials advertised as much as 2 million Syrian pounds, around $40,000, for reliable information leading to Nicole or identifying someone involved in her disappearance. Even Canada's ambassador to Syria, Mark Bailey, remained affected by the case. Years later, his obituary described his inability to find Nicole as one of the poignant regrets of his diplomatic career. But despite years of searching, despite police investigations, despite trips across Syria, despite television appearances, newspaper advertisements, reward money, and hundreds of strangers trying to reconstruct Nicole's movements, the fundamental evidence in this case has barely moved beyond where it stood in 2007. No bank transactions, no emails, no passport crossings, no photographs or sightings. Not even a witness that can place her anywhere other than the hotel on March 31st. And maybe that's the detail I find saddest about Nicole's disappearance. She had crossed continents alone. She had traveled through Asia, Latin America, Africa, and the Middle East. She had navigated buses and borders and remote villages for years. But somehow, less than 48 hours after arriving in Hama, Nicole disappeared during what should have been one of the simplest parts of her trip, a Saturday morning sightseeing excursion. And nearly 20 years later, we still don't know whether Nicole ever made it beyond the streets surrounding her hotel.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
So what happened to Nicole Viano? The frustrating answer is that even after all these years, nobody knows. 5 years after Nicole disappeared, her brother Matthew said that despite everything the family had done, there were still no real clues, no confirmed sightings, no physical evidence. Nothing that clearly pointed investigators in one direction. But he also said that, privately, the family had become increasingly suspicious that someone connected to the hotel may have known more than what they were saying. When you look at the timeline, I understand why. Because Nicole does not disappear at some remote ruins in the middle of nowhere. She disappeared from a hotel in a city. And every reliable piece of evidence seems to bring us right back there. First, I think we can probably rule out the idea that Nicole just decided to start a new life somewhere. Could she have walked away voluntarily? Technically, yes. But I find that really hard to believe. Nicole left behind her journals, her photographs, her camera memory cards, her clothing, and other personal belongings. And these weren't random things that she didn't care about. Her journals and photographs were incredibly important to her. She had spent months documenting her travels. People close to her said she was very protective of those things. She also left money behind. Her bank accounts stopped being used. Her email activity stopped. Her savings went untouched. Her Syrian visa expired April 5th, and her Canadian passport was never used to enter Turkey, which was supposed to be her next destination. So for Nicole to have disappeared on purpose, she would have had to leave behind basically everything she cared about. Never access her money again. Never contact her fiancé. Never contact her family. And somehow maintain that disappearance for the rest of her life. I just don't think that fits the person we've gotten to know. Something happened to her. The real question is where? One possibility is that Nicole did exactly what the hotel clerk said she did. Maybe she left the hotel around 8:30 that morning and started walking toward the minibus stop. Maybe she got partway there and someone offered her a ride. And to me, that's one of the more believable possibilities. Nicole was an experienced traveler. She was comfortable using local transportation, asking strangers for directions, and figuring things out as she went. And all the places she wanted to visit that day were not all conveniently on one bus line. She may have needed to take a minibus, then find another car, possibly accept a ride for the final stretch. So maybe someone stopped and said, "Hey, I'm going that way." Maybe it was a taxi driver. Maybe it was someone from the hotel. Maybe it was just a local person seeming friendly. And maybe Nicole got into that car. Now that would explain a lot. It could explain why no minibus driver remembered her. It could explain why nobody saw her at the tourist sites. And it could explain one detail that has always bothered me. Nicole left her handwritten directions behind in her hotel room. Now, according to the clerk, she had spent time carefully copying down instructions for how to reach the Beehive Houses and Qasr Ibn Warden. Then those directions were found in her room. Maybe she forgot them. That's completely possible. But Nicole was an experienced traveler. She was organized, and she had spent all that time writing those directions down. It seemed strange she would just walk out without them, unless she didn't need them anymore. Maybe someone offered her a direct ride. Maybe the plan changed. It doesn't prove anything, but it does make you wonder. And then we get to the part of the case that bothers me the most. Nobody else saw her that morning. Now think about that. The day before, people remembered Nicole. They remembered seeing her at Apamea. They remembered her exploring. They remembered her reading. She stood out. She was a Western woman traveling alone. She didn't wear traditional clothing. She didn't cover her hair. She was reportedly wearing a bright red shirt. She was noticeable. But the only person who says he saw her that morning is the hotel clerk, inside the hotel. And that's why people have questioned whether Nicole ever really made it out of the hotel at all. The clerk said she left around 8:30, but did she? The possibility has always existed that something happened before she ever left the hotel. Which brings us back to the clerk. Now, I want to be really careful here because there's no proof that the hotel clerk harmed Nicole. He was never convicted of anything connected to her disappearance. But he is interesting because he may have been the last person to see her, and possibly the only person to see her on the day she disappeared. He had been working the graveyard shift. He was also reportedly the last person to see Nicole the night before, sometime before midnight. So according to the known timeline, he potentially sees her late Friday night and then again the next morning, and then Nicole is gone. Some independent investigators later focused heavily on him. There were claims that he left the hotel sometime after Nicole disappeared and started another business. There were also claims that around that same time period, he received a significant amount of money from a Tunisian woman. Now, she reportedly said she had given him the money as an investment and believed he had deceived her. Now, does that mean the money had anything to do with Nicole? No, there's no evidence that it did. But because Nicole disappeared at around the same time, people naturally became suspicious. There were also reports from an independent investigator that the clerk took a polygraph, and that the results suggested he knew more than he admitted. Again, polygraphs are not proof. And I have not found a police report publicly confirming all of those details. But even if the clerk had nothing to do with Nicole's disappearance, there is another possibility. Maybe he saw something. Maybe he saw someone come to the hotel. Maybe someone picked Nicole up. Maybe he saw her leave with someone. Maybe he does know more than he realizes. Or maybe he knows exactly what happened and has always been too afraid to say anything. We just don't know. And it's also possible that he's completely innocent. Maybe he really was just the last person unlucky enough to see Nicole before she disappeared. Because that happens too. But because there is so little evidence in this case, his account has always carried an enormous amount of weight. And there's another version of the hotel theory that's even darker. What if Nicole was taken from her room? Her room was reportedly on the fourth floor. There were bathrooms and a balcony nearby. And according to one independent account of the investigation, her door did not have a deadbolt that would have prevented someone with a key from entering. So imagine this. Nicole comes back from Apamea Friday evening. She writes in her journal. She plans what she wants to see the next day. Maybe she packs a small day bag before going to sleep. Her bigger backpack stays behind because she's only planning to be gone for the day. Then somebody comes to the room. Maybe it's someone she knows. Maybe she leaves voluntarily, or maybe she doesn't. If that happened, the fact that her larger belongings were left behind suddenly makes perfect sense. And if somebody later says she walked out at 8:30, then the entire search begins in the wrong place. There's also the question of why nobody at the hotel raised the alarm. Nicole's belongings were reportedly still there weeks later. She had disappeared. She never came back. Apparently, nobody at the hotel contacted authorities or her family. Now, there could be a totally innocent explanation for that. Backpackers changed their plans. Maybe hotel staff assumed she would return. Maybe they thought she had gone somewhere overnight. Maybe nobody realized how unusual it was. But from a human perspective, it still feels strange. A foreign woman disappears. Her belongings are still sitting in her room. Days pass, then weeks. And nobody seems to be asking where she is. It doesn't prove anything. With a case with almost no evidence, those details start to matter. Another theory that has come up is human trafficking. And I want to be very cautious with that, because there's no evidence proving Nicole was trafficked. During that period, Syria was dealing with enormous numbers of Iraqi refugees. There were serious concerns about women and girls being exploited, sold, or forced into prostitution because of poverty and displacement. So trafficking did exist in the region, but it doesn't mean Nicole became a victim of it. Some wondered whether the hotel could have somehow been connected to that kind of activity, especially because of the unexplained payment to the clerk. But again, investigators apparently believed the Tunisian woman's explanation for the money. Now, personally, trafficking is not the theory I find most convincing. Nicole had money, a passport, she was expected home. Once her disappearance became international news, she would have been an incredibly risky person to keep hidden. To me, a much simpler possibility is that she encountered someone who met her harm. Someone with a car. Someone at the hotel. Someone sightseeing. And that's the last time anyone ever sees her. There were also theories involving Syrian police or the military. Now, Matthew acknowledged that people had suggested this to his family. Maybe Nicole accidentally ended up somewhere sensitive. Maybe there was an accident involving a government vehicle. Maybe she crossed paths with a soldier. But Matthew was careful about this theory. He said the family had no evidence that the Syrian government was involved, and that the officials they dealt with appeared to genuinely want to help find Nicole. And that makes sense. Nicole was not political. She was not an activist. She wasn't a journalist. She wasn't investigating the Syrian government. She was just there because she loved history and architecture. So I don't think she was deliberately targeted by the government. But in this case, almost nothing can be completely ruled out. But then the search for Nicole became even more difficult, almost impossible. War. By 2012, it was no longer the country Nicole had traveled through in 2007. The uprising had begun. The civil war was escalating. Tourism had essentially disappeared. People were fleeing, businesses were closing, and cities were becoming dangerous. And Hama was no longer somewhere Nicole's family could casually return to and keep retracing her steps. Canada eventually withdrew its diplomats and government staff from Syria and urged Canadians to leave. And this changed everything for Nicole's family, because they had already been fighting time. Now they were fighting a war. Anyone who might have remembered Nicole could have moved, fled the country, died, lost internet access. Records disappeared. Places Nicole visited were damaged or destroyed. And even if someone finally wanted to come forward, they may not have had a safe or reliable way to do it. When Nicole disappeared, the country was somewhere her family could still search. They could fly there, walk through Hama, talk to hotel employees, retrace her route, and then slowly the access disappeared. Meanwhile, life kept moving forward without Nicole. Matthew got married and had a baby. Nicole's stepbrother had a baby. There were other weddings, more children. Nicole became an aunt to nieces she never got to meet. And I think about that a lot, because when somebody disappears, we tend to freeze them in the moment they vanished. Nicole is always going to be 32, but everyone around her keeps aging. Entire generations grow up. And every one of those milestones becomes another thing Nicole should have been there for. Her family has said that even years later, people still email them. Travelers who had been to Syria in 2007. People who wondered if maybe they'd seen Nicole. People trying to help. So she was never forgotten. There just wasn't ever a breakthrough.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
So, what are my travel tips for Syria today? Obviously, don't go. And I don't say that because Syria isn't beautiful. It absolutely is. I would love to see Syria. I would love to see the ancient markets, the mosques, the ruins, and places travelers like Nicole once moved through so freely. But right now, the risk is simply too high. Like I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, as of July 2026, Canada and the U.S. advise travelers to avoid all travel to Syria because of armed clashes, airstrikes, kidnapping, terrorism, and criminal activity. So this isn't one of those situations where I would tell you to be careful, stay in a tourist neighborhood, and avoid going out alone at night. This is a genuine wait situation. And hopefully it's just that, a wait. Because I really hope there comes a time when Syria can once again be known to travelers for the things it was known for before the war. Incredible history, beautiful architecture, amazing food, ancient cities, and the hospitality of its people. The people and culture are not the danger here. The current security situation is. And someday, hopefully, that changes, because Syria has an extraordinary amount to offer the world. I just wouldn't recommend seeing it right now. Nearly 20 years have passed since Nicole Viano disappeared in Hama, Syria. She was 32 years old, 5'6", and approximately 130 pounds, with brown hair and brown eyes. She wore contact lenses. When Nicole was last reportedly seen, she was wearing a white long-sleeved shirt with a red t-shirt layered over it, khaki pants, a red baseball cap, red-tinted sunglasses, gray and black New Balance sneakers, and carrying a blue backpack. Her family has spent years searching for answers, traveling repeatedly to Syria and enlisting hundreds of people around the world to help reconstruct Nicole's final movements. And despite all of that searching, Nicole has never been found. Her family has offered substantial reward money in hopes that someone will finally come forward. If you were traveling in Syria in March of 2007, particularly around Hama, or you have any information about Nicole's disappearance, no matter how insignificant it may seem, please contact the appropriate Canadian authorities. Because after all these years, it may only take one person remembering something they saw, heard, or were told to finally give Nicole's family the answers they've been waiting for. Nicole Vianu has been missing since March 31st, 2007. She has never been forgotten. And hopefully, someday, she will finally come home. And finally, remember to leave a review and rate this podcast 5 stars if you like the show, or hell, even if you don't. But either way, feel free to let me know what you think. Please follow The Last Trip on Instagram at The Last Trip Crime Pod, and subscribe on Patreon to support the show. You'll get extra research, videos, photos, and updates, and even learn more about my personal travels. That's patreon.com/thelasttrippodcast. I'm Jamie Beebe, bringing you your last trip and signing off until the next one. Thanks for listening.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.